Hi, I'm Patty Campbell. Welcome to The Writer's Voice. Today, I'm coming to you from New Haven, Connecticut, the Yale University campus. In 2012, Yale University is doing its first summer writers conference. And today, for The Writer's Voice, we have an instructor and a Yale alum with us. Her name is M.G. Lord.
Hi, Patty. It's great to be here.
You have been here leading a workshop on nonfiction, and you are really known as an investigative journalist and a cultural critic. Many people will also recognize your name from your very fine reviews that you do for the New York Times. We want to talk a little bit about your latest book, The Accidental Feminist, How Elizabeth Taylor Raised Our Consciousness and We Were Too Distracted by Her Beauty to Notice. But before we get onto that, I just want to find out a little bit about your career path. You came from California back east to go to school. Then what happened?
Well, you may not realize this, but as Gary Trudeau pointed out to me, Gary Trudeau, the creator of Doonesbury, Yale University is, in fact, possibly the foremost cartooning academy in the Northeast. He, of course, is an alumnus. And when I was at Yale, I was the political cartoonist for the Yale Daily News. And as a consequence of this, I had a really unusual career right after college. I was hired by Newsday, the Long Island newspaper, then the ninth largest newspaper in the country, to be its editorial cartoonist. I also had worked with at Yale. Yale had this wonderful thing called residential college seminars where they just brought in people in different fields. And Bill Malden, the world famous multi-Pulitzer Prize winning World War II cartoonist who is no longer with us, taught a seminar here on political cartooning. And after he saw my work, he put his meaty arm around me and he said, "Put your LSAT study guide in the trash compactor. There are no women doing this and I'll get you a job." And between my portfolio and his help and the help of Gary Trudeau, I managed to leave Yale and start working at Newsday, which was a really fun job in my 20s.
And he was telling the truth. You really were one of the first of the women.
There weren't very many. I myself was always interested in writing, and while working at Newsday as a cartoonist, I kept trying to shove novels in my talk balloons to the point where the editors finally gave me a humor column. And I wrote about finding my childhood Barbie dolls at one point, baroquely cross-dressed. And this column led to Forever Barbie, which was great because it came at a time when the newspapers were beginning to go south and I wanted a career change.
Now, we're talking about Forever Barbie, the unauthorized biography of a real doll. Did that come before AstroTurf, which is your other book?
Forever Barbie did very well. It was, actually, it was a great piece of reporting because it was all the apocryphal stories about this amazing doll. I mean, the business story alone is astonishing. The doll was invented by a woman who co-founded the company Mattel that made the doll, but it was knocked off of a German porn doll that was originally sold to adult men by this woman who went on to be the biggest white-collar felon in the state of California before Michael Milken. At one point, there was a substantial, I can't recall exactly, but something along the lines of an $18 million disparity between Mattel's reported income and its actual income. And the woman, Ruth Handler, pleaded no contest to fraud, basically, to, falsifying SEC information, et cetera. And she was sentenced to 57,000 hours of community service. But, I mean, it's a classic rise-fall redemption story. She makes a fortune with Barbie. She has a misstep and has to leave her own company. But then, and this is really implausible, she went on to make a second fortune designing mastectomy prostheses, as she said to me in 1992 over an egg salad sandwich at the Hillcrest Country Club in Los Angeles. "Honey, all my life I've gone from breast to breast."
How wonderful. Is all of that included?
Oh, absolutely. It's the definitive book. And, I was meticulous about the research. Again, because the stories about the doll were apocryphal and something that in the 70s and 80s collectors talked about, but there was no evidence. I mean, the German porn doll was originally based on a cartoon character in the Bild-Zeitung, a sort of downscale German newspaper similar to our National Enquirer. And the real genius of Ruth Handler at Mattel was taking this slutty doll, you know, that I read German, so I read 3 years of the cartoon, and in every single panel, it was a single panel cartoon, the Lily character, the doll was the Lily doll, takes money from jowly fat men for sexual favors. The ultimate emblematic cartoon was Lily holding up a little newspaper to cover her naked body, and she's with a female friend in the friend's apartment, and she says to the friend, "We had a fight, and he took back all his presents."
Oh my gosh.
So that gives you a sense of the personality, and I mean, Ruth Handler's genius was to take this German streetwalker and recast her as the girl, the American girl next door. It was brilliant.
And what a joke on all of us who had our Barbie dolls. Well, that book must have sold very well for you.
Well, it did, and publishers allowed me to do what I wanted to do next, and all I really wanted to, my mother died when I was a child, and my father was a rocket engineer, and during the years when my mother was dying, he disappeared into the Jet Propulsion Laboratory, and all these many years later, you know, after Barbie was published, I was in my 30s, the thing I really burned to know was, where did that damn man go? So my next book is kind of a history of, an informal history of the Jet Propulsion Laboratory, and almost inadvertently, an odyssey of forgiveness, because I forgave my father for his disappearance. You know, I was an only child, and again, my mother died when I was, you know, between the ages, for me, the ages of 10 and 14.
Which must have left you as lonely.
But I kind of brought myself up,
yeah.
But I don't think I did a terribly bad job, actually, but I did.
Not as success as any measure. Oh,
thank you, Patty. But you know, but I resented that absence for years, and I not only wrote a history of the lab, but I also spent a lot of time with a team, with the Mars Exploration Rover team, that you know, landed the Spirit and Opportunity rovers on Mars in 2004. And what I found was I was absolutely as riveted, you know, by what they did as my father had been. So again, it's a cliche, but odyssey of forgiveness.
And discovering that you are your father's.
A little bit, yeah. I mean, you know, and of course, because I'm a cultural critic, and I mean, the book is a memoir and has a strong memoir component, but I didn't just want to write about my father. I was really interested in the whole idea of masculinity during the Cold War, the way that to be a man, you had to place thinking above feeling, repression over emotion, being in the public sphere as opposed to being at home, where when I was growing up, I felt he really needed to be. But I understood the ethos a lot more, and I was able to write about, you know, the breakthroughs, the first women who got important jobs at the Jet Propulsion Lab. I will tell you, though, the hardest thing maybe I've ever done in my life, I had to do on this project. You know those little badges with your picture on them,
yeah,
that in NASA centers you wear around your neck, you know,
right.
And
those so badges they make
exactly.
That have absolutely unrecognizable pictures always.
Right, exactly, and you scan in to have access. I needed this to do the kind of reporting I wanted to do, and it was exceptionally challenging to get it when my principal credential was a social history of the Barbie doll.
But you got it.
Yeah, but I prevailed.
Well, now, the book was called AstroTurf, The Private Life of Rocket Science. Where does the AstroTurf come in?
Well, there are a lot of turf battles, you know, between women and men over,
oh,
you know,
so you're
over
not
projects.
Talking about the green stuff.
No, I mean, and actually it's not a single word, as is the product. I mean, it, you know, it's clearly a pun that didn't work for everyone. In fact, I still admire
it. I get it now.
Well, I still like the title. But one of the more horrifying stories, a friend of mine sent me an email right after the book came out, and he told me that at his bookstore in Carmel, they had placed my, you know, cultural history of a lab and poignant memoir of my father, the New York Times said, on the astrology shelf.
Oh, my gosh. Somebody didn't read
yeah.
the book before they blazed it. Well, now,
well, actually, these days, with the fact that there are so few bookstores, just merely having it on a shelf in a bookstore seems like a quaint and wonderful thing.
Yes, yes. Well, when I was doing some of the research for this interview, I looked at Amazon. And I looked at the MG Lord page on Amazon where it says that you are interested in curvaceous, charismatic icons of femininity. I wrote that phrase down. Barbie, certainly, but also this
Elizabeth Taylor, the new book.
Right,
yeah, the New York Times review was really lovely. It compared me to Melville, Tolstoy, and Mark Twain. The catch is, of course, that I am the Herman Melville of mid-century sex icons, but I'll take it.
Yeah, absolutely, as long as they're reviewing. Well, tell me about the book on Elizabeth Taylor. I know that you have met her. But that was not the genesis of this book, was it?
Well, no, I mean, what happened, it's a very idea-driven book. It's about the subversive feminist themes in her movies. And I would never watch these movies, except one Memorial Day weekend a few years ago, I found myself trapped in a vacation house with a bunch of young people, Gen Y and Gen X, and nothing for entertainment but a couple box sets of Elizabeth Taylor DVDs. Well, we didn't know much about Elizabeth Taylor, and we expected, you know, a night of really campy movies. But instead, when we started watching, we were blown away, not just by the quality of her performances, but by the feminist themes in her movies. In National Velvet, her 12-year-old character challenges gender discrimination, excluded from an important horse race because she's a girl. She poses as a male jockey, enters the race, and wins. A Place in the Sun, her next big movie, is an abortion rights movie. Her next big one, Butterfield 8, challenges the right of a woman to own her own body. Her character isn't censured because she's a prostitute, but because she chooses the men with whom she'll sleep. She controls her sexuality. Even Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf can be seen as a movie about what happens to an educated woman when the only way society permits her to express herself is through her husband's career or children. And we were just blown away. And I wondered, you know, first I wondered if we had been projecting 21st century ideas onto 20th century movies. So I started doing a little research in the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences, Margaret Herrick Library, the archive. Mm-hmm. And what I found were memos from the censors, the Production Code Administration, who between 1934 and 1967 controlled the content of all American movies. And I discovered that the censors had seen exactly what we had seen and had worked really hard to scrub it out. Just to refresh your memory, A Place in the Sun was an adaptation of Theodore Dreiser's An American Tragedy. There had been two earlier movie adaptations, but they were disasters because basically the novel is anti-capitalist agitprop. You know, it's about a working class man who goes to work in his rich uncle's factory, and he's forbidden from both socializing with his uncle's social circle, but also with his fellow factory workers. But he's lonely, and he accidentally impregnates a colleague on the assembly line.
Charlie Winters.
Exactly. But in the novel, the ideas are very reductive. After impregnating her, he then falls in love with a rich woman in the movie played by Elizabeth Taylor. But in earlier adaptations, what I mean by reductive is that the working class guy was just a total social climbing cad. And the sort of sad sack working class girl was noble. And the rich girl was just some dumb creature that the guy fell for because of her money. But George Stevens, who directed A Place in the Sun, realized that what would make his movie more than a piece of anti-capitalist propaganda was if the audience could believe that the working class man, played beautifully by Montgomery Clift, actually fell in love with the rich woman, not with her money, but with the woman herself. And I found in the archives memos from George Stevens to his producer. He had a list of 30 actresses he thought could play the pregnant factory girl, and Shelley Winters did a wonderful job, but she was by no means his first choice. But he only had one actress whom he believed could convince an audience that a man had fallen in love with her for herself and her beauty, not her money, and that one actress was the 18-year-old Elizabeth Taylor. You know, the other thing that's so interesting with the relationship of directors to the censors, the Production Code Administration, was the censors could control every word of dialogue, but they couldn't control the nonverbal things that actors who exuded, for instance, a sexual intensity, what they conveyed to the viewers nonverbally. And I think one of the things he saw in the young Elizabeth Taylor was an ability to completely override an audience's prefrontal cortex, the part of the brain that processes language, and go right for the amygdala, the mother load of emotion, you know, the aft brain, the ancient brain, you know, and evoke a level of feeling in an audience.
We were too distracted by her beauty to really realize
exactly
what she was doing.
Well, there are extraordinary speeches in movies like Giant that are, for the middle 1950s, there are, her character in Giant, an educated woman from the East Coast, marries this thug, cattle rancher, you know, cattle baron, really, played by Rock Hudson, who is misogynistic and very bigoted toward his Mexican workers. But in terms of the misogyny, she, looking stunningly beautiful, not like some army boot-wearing caricature of a feminist, but just jaw-dropping, you know, in a sort of Greek costume. She challenges the men, the fellow cattle ranchers after dinner, and basically accuses them of being so antiquated in their thinking that they date back 100,000 years. They should be wearing animal skins and carrying clubs. It's a very powerful speech and jaw-dropping in a 1950s movie.
And yet, not so jaw-dropping if you missed it because you were looking at how
beautiful,
really,
yeah,
beautiful she was. I remember Gloria Steinem was, had a little bit of trouble establishing her credibility, or if she didn't have trouble establishing her credibility as a feminist, the news story on her was, what's such an attractive woman doing talking about this stuff? And we don't associate beauty and feminism sometimes, or at least when this was all getting started.
Well, of course, Elizabeth Taylor didn't write these films or direct these films, but directors saw in her, you know, a kind of strength that I think she herself would only discover later in life when her film career was sort of over and she became, you know, not just a leader, but the leader in AIDS philanthropy at a time when the Republican administration, the beginning of an epidemic in the early 1980s when the Republican administration in Washington turned a blind eye to the epidemic because the people
was actually saying this is their due.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, I think President Reagan felt that his landslide victory in 1980 was in large part due to the moral majority, and its leader, Jerry Falwell, essentially said that AIDS was God's punishment on homosexuals, so what should have been a medical problem suddenly became a political problem. Exactly. The President of the United States didn't even utter the acronym AIDS until 1987, 5 years into the epidemic. And Elizabeth began to be involved publicly with the cause in 1985 after her very close friend, Rock Hudson, you know, with whom she'd co-starred in Giants, was not just diagnosed with AIDS, but died. And her first fundraiser was for AIDS Project Los Angeles in the fall of 1985. Now, the CDC, in the first year of the epidemic, had spent, I think, something like $1 million on AIDS research and preventive education, and $3 million on Legionnaire's disease. It's shocking. But in this one night, she raised more money in that one night than the CDC had spent on AIDS in the first couple of years of the epidemic.
She really was an amazing person.
Yeah, and it was as if she harnessed her outrageous fame to do something useful. You know, she wasn't a very educated woman. She was a contract player at MGM since she was a child, so she got, you know, what formal education she got. She got an MGM's Little Red Schoolhouse with other child actors. But I think she learned things from the extraordinary director she worked with and the role she played. For instance, in Giant, her character is very concerned with social justice. She's forbidden by her husband to go into the community of Mexican workers that serves his massive cattle ranch, but she goes into that community anyway. And in one home, she finds a sick child. And instead of pushing that child away from her, she embraces the child in the same way that she didn't push her gay friends away from her at the beginning of the epidemic. She embraced them when other people in Hollywood who had benefited from their talents were were shunning them. And the character in Giant then goes back to the ranch, as it were, and persuades the physician who only tends the white ranchers, who only tends the privileged community, to take care of this sick child in much the same way that in real life, so many years later, Elizabeth Taylor forced a callous nation to recognize the humanity and the suffering of a marginalized community, and also pretty much forced the privileged community's physicians to address this enormous health problem. She was amazing, and I really admire her. Some people accuse me of writing a hagiography, but that was the point. I mean, the point was to celebrate something that had never been recognized about this. You know, she wasn't all jewelry and husbands and Oscars. There was this profound commitment to social justice over a long period of time. And her stepdaughter, Kate Burton, the mm-hmm. actress, mm-hmm. Richard Burton's daughter, she was very helpful to me, and I told her I was going to call the book The Accidental Feminist, because I think that, you know, she was like the beautiful somnambulist in Harold Lloyd's High and Dizzy, out there on an ideological ledge, but sleeping and sleepwalking, not quite knowing where she was. But by the time of her AIDS work, she really woke up, and Kate Burton agreed, and she characterized her AIDS work as her greatest conscious gift.
We're interested in hearing something from the book. Could you read from the book for us?
Well, I'll go the cheesy route and go with something funny and not something profound. Is that okay, Patty?
That's fine. And we'll talk about the profound stuff
yeah.
on the other side of the reading. But we've been talking about the profound stuff.
All right. Well, and I'll provide ellipses and abridgments so I don't bend your listener's ear too much. But, you
okay.
know, Elizabeth had a lot of health problems all her life.
Yeah, seemed that way.
Yeah, major back surgery. I think she had some equestrian accidents during the filming of, I mean, it began early during the filming of National Velvet, and no leisure, because at first she supported her parents and then she supported her children, no leisure in which to heal. So we're going to talk a little bit about her health problems, including the famous tracheotomy that she had in London. I won't elaborate. We'll just plunge right in.
Okay.
Okay. Oh, and she was married to Eddie Fisher, by the way, in the late 1950s, so his name doesn't come out of the blue for younger listeners. Anyway, in his memoir, Eddie Fisher writes with odd wistfulness of his time with Taylor and its glamorous backdrops, a bungalow at the Beverly Hills Hotel, a suite at the Park Lane in Manhattan, quarters designed by Oliver Messel at the Dorchester in London, as well as emergency rooms on two continents. As I read his descriptions, I began to understand. When I needed a break from this manuscript, I stayed at a hotel. But when you live in a hotel, where do you go to escape? To the hospital. This is only half facetious. As a child, Taylor supported her parents financially. After Mike Todd's death, she supported her children by herself. To survive, her family depended on her. And to support them, Taylor depended on her appearance. She couldn't look puffy or haggard on screen. She had to look fantastic, or in any event, thin. If her director told her to smile, she had to radiate sunshine. She had to dredge within herself to play a scene with feeling. She was always going, going, going. But if she became really sick, sick enough to die, the carousel stopped. A dead star could derail a film and cost the studio money. In sickness, she could escape her burdens. In sickness, she could rest. Fisher recounts one harrowing near-death experience after another. While shooting Butterfield 8, Taylor fell prey to pneumonia and could barely breathe. Passed out from cold medication, she was whisked on a stretcher from the Park Lane to Harkness Pavilion. As the ambulance approached the emergency room, however, Fisher recalls, Taylor sat up, rummaged for a compact, and handed Fisher her purse. "Get me my lip gloss," she ordered. As soon as Taylor recovered from pneumonia, she again went to a hospital, this time as a visitor to Fisher's ailing mother in Philadelphia. But the pull of the ER proved irresistible. Before returning to New York, Taylor slipped on some ice, sprained her ankle, and received emergency treatment. She left Philadelphia on crutches. Now we're going to compress a little bit.
Okay.
And move her from New York to London, where a first iteration of Cleopatra, the final version of which was filmed in Italy, this first iteration was started, and it was ridiculous. I mean, it was freezing in London. It was very difficult to create Alexander in a situation where it was freezing. And the short version is Elizabeth became very sick. So we'll pick this up here in London, pretending that it's balmy Alexandria and Elizabeth is unwell. Taylor's health worsened. The problems, Fisher explained, had as much to do with her back as with her lungs. She needed shots of Demerol, which she administered, to ease the chronic pain. By late February, fighting Staphylococcus pneumonia, she burned constantly with fever. At night, she slept beneath an oxygen tent in her hotel room. On March 3, 1961, the infection and the painkillers became too much. She slipped into a coma. Fisher noticed nothing unusual, but Taylor's private nurse flew into action, summoning a doctor who began mouth-to-mouth resuscitation. Lashed to a stretcher, Taylor was rushed to the London clinic, where Fisher, in shock, gave permission for doctors to plunge a knife into his wife's throat. The incision created a tracheotomy, a passage through which air could again reach Taylor's congested lungs. With a tube poking through a hole in her neck, Taylor was alive, but just barely. She still couldn't kick the infection. The crowds that had railed against her for stealing Debbie Reynolds' husband, for snubbing the British hairdressers, suddenly rallied in support. Hundreds of people kept vigil day and night while Elizabeth fought for her life, Fisher wrote. People everywhere loved her and were praying for her recovery. Visitors like Tennessee Williams, John Wayne, and Truman Capote struggled to cheer her. Cards and letters poured in, so many that the hospital collected them in laundry baskets. Walter Wanger, producer of Cleopatra, recalled a telegram sent from the United States. 6,000 of us are playing for you at the Boeing plant. We know you'll pull through. But the stubborn infection would not capitulate. As Fisher tells it, a week after the tracheotomy, a British doctor injected Taylor with gamma globulin, and the infection finally gave up. Discharged from the hospital, Taylor identified with Lazarus. She flew to Los Angeles, where she described her ordeal at a fundraiser for Cedars of Lebanon and Mount Sinai hospitals. Dying, as I remember it, is many things, she said. Mostly it was lonely, and she was glad to be back. But she remained in touch with the angel of death, whom she met on the other side, and who often told her, psychically, when other people would die. Nominated for Best Actress in Butterfield 8, Taylor planned to attend the Academy Awards ceremony. Her main competition that year was Shirley MacLaine, nominated for The Apartment. Today, MacLaine is as well known for her psychic experiences as for her acting. A believer in reincarnation, she has written 10 books that detail her past lives. In 1961, however, MacLaine was the rationalist and Taylor the mystic. And one wonders whether Taylor's win, the triumph of the mystic, might have inspired MacLaine's spiritual journey. Before Taylor returned from the grave, MacLaine was the odds-on favorite. Without rancor, MacLaine said, I lost to a tracheotomy. Fortified by her Oscar win, as well as a summer in Los Angeles, Taylor and Fisher flew to Rome, where she began the final version of Cleopatra. While Taylor had languished in the hospital, version one had officially bitten the dust. In the new iteration, Rex Harrison was Julius Caesar, and Richard Burton was Mark Antony. Taylor and Burton were not immediately drawn to each other. Acclaimed as a Shakespearean actor, Burton dismissed Taylor as, quote, MGM's Little Miss Mamary. As he watched her work, however, he came to admire her craft. From the get-go, he had coveted Taylor's earning power. Soon he would come to covet Taylor herself. Walter Wanger recalls their first scene together in Cleopatra's Roman villa on January 22, 1962. Taylor was, quote, elegant in a simple yellow gown. Burton was, quote, handsome, arrogant, and vigorous, unquote, in his knee-length toga. And between the two of them, not my cliche, quote, you could almost feel the electricity. By mid-February, the Burton-Taylor love affair had exploded, ripping their respective marriages asunder. The press called it le scandale. L'Osservatore della Domenica, the Vatican Weekly, called it, quote, erotic vagrancy. Vatican Radio called it, quote, the caprices of adult children. and the publicity department at 20th Century Fox called it a godsend. Typically, the Vatican did not comment on the private lives of movie stars, but Taylor had galled the papacy to its core, not because of her extramarital affair, that was commonplace, slight, but because of something else, something truly extraordinary, something no undeserving erotic great vagrant should have been permitted to accomplish. In London, 1 year earlier, Taylor had died, but she had not stayed that way. She had, to the Vatican's horror, been resurrected.
I'm curious, Inchi, do you think she was playing parts, or do you think she was interested in taking on these roles because she wanted to use these roles as a platform for making feminist statements?
I call the book The Accidental Feminist. I think she blundered into these parts because directors saw her strength that she herself did not even see. But I think she learned from the parts that, she learned things about the world from the parts that she played. One of my goals in writing this book is to encourage younger people to look at these movies. I think some young women who refuse to identify as feminists because they somehow think that this would require them to wear army boots, they might just want to take a look at A Place in the Sun and see what the world looked like before Roe v. Wade. And many of these movies, I mean, see what the world looked like when women were, you know, not allowed to control with whom they slept. I mean, the choice in the 1950s was either to be rented like a prostitute or purchased like a wife, because that was the nature of the marriage arrangement. And in Butterfield 8, her character scrawls "no sale" on a mirror. It's a very powerful scene. And also, when a man who is infatuated with her character, in that movie, the man played by Lawrence Harvey, starts offering her lavish gifts, and she explains, you know, that she's refused gifts that were even more lavish. And to make her point, she impales him with her stiletto heel, and finally it dawns on him. He says, "Now I get it. You pick the man. He doesn't pick you." And she says, "Finally, why I'm not teaching logic at Columbia, I'll never know."
What's your next writing project?
Well, I'm going in a very different direction. It isn't exactly a writing project. You know, I was for 12 years a syndicated political cartoonist based at Newsday. And I teach a course at USC on writing the graphic novel, which has gotten me really interested in storytelling through sequential art. So I'm now working with a neuroscientist, Dr. Indre Viscontis, who is a young woman in her early 30s. And we're putting together, I guess that's the correct verb, we're writing and I'm drawing, a graphic novel that deals with the brain and is, I think just I'll just be vague, that deals with the brain and is set in the brain.
What's it like for you to go back to the drawing?
Well, things have changed so much in that area too. You know, in the old days you used to draw with a pen on paper. But now, if you submit a graphic novel, you don't submit actual sheets of artwork. You submit a printable PDF. So I'm learning Adobe Illustrator and Adobe Photoshop. I'm learning how to use the software myself, which is, there's a very steep learning curve and it's very challenging. And my 32-year-old neuroscientist collaborator is always saying things to me like, "Well, that's great, MG. This keeps your brain pliable. This keeps you young." And I confess I find that a tiny bit irritating, but it's absolutely true.
Well, we'll look forward to seeing it.
It was a treat to meet you here.
Oh, it was great to meet you, and I thank you very much for taking time out to be here with us on The Writer's Voice. We've been talking to MG Lord. She is the author of, well, most recently, The Accidental Feminist, How Elizabeth Taylor Raised Our Consciousness and We Were Too Distracted by Her Beauty to Notice. I'm Patty Campbell. Thank you for joining us here on The Virginia Voice.